You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Works better when you turn the microphone on. Hi, folks. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth, thanks for being here at the show. And those of you joining us for the very, very first time, welcome. I'm glad you're here. And I'm delighted, and I think you will be too, and I hope you make a habit out of it. Come back each and every night, Monday through Friday. Monday through Friday. Every once in a while, I get an email from someone who says, hey, I just found your show. I had no idea you existed. And I am so thrilled. I'm so delighted that I found the show. Well, if you're one of those folks and this is your first night, I'm delighted too. My guest tonight is Dr. Bruce Maccabee, truly one of the stellar names in the field of UFO investigations. And he's online and will join us in just a moment. And I am really looking forward to having the opportunity to talk with him again. It's been quite some time since he's been with us on the show. Tonight is K-Files night. That means our free weekly newsletter, the K-Files e-zine, will start going out tonight. Now, if you are not getting the K-Files e-zine, if you're not subscribed, what you need to do is go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. It's not kevinsmith.com. If you do that, you're going to get the movie producer. If you want this show, it's kevinsmithshow.com. And just click, it's in red letters, says K-Files e-zine. Absolutely free, no strings attached. We don't share or rent, lease, lend, or sell our email list to anybody. So you're not going to be spammed as a result of subscribing to the K-Files e-zine. Now, if you haven't subscribed, ask yourself, where's the genius in that? It's free, and it's got all the inside information on what's going on in the show and with the show and with the website. That's how we stay in touch and let everybody know. Plus, there are always interesting articles and links to really interesting videos and other cool things in the e-zine, so be sure you get it. The clearance sale I announced yesterday, and that's Ed Grimsley's UFO Wars, $10 plus $2 shipping and handling, total of $12, normally sells for $24.95. That clearance sale ends when the show ends tonight. So if you were planning to get it, you sent me an email as I requested, and I sent you a link. And if you haven't used that, but you want to get this, it's over when the show's over tonight. Okay? So you need to kind of hurry on that. Now, this weekend is catch-up weekend for me. You know, 2 weeks prior, for almost 2 weeks, every single day, I had to reinstall the entire website because we were getting hacked every single day. That finally has somewhat subsided. We're still, parts of it are getting hit, but it's not the entire thing, and that's a good deal. I still have a few things that I have to fix on the site. Plus, I am trying to answer emails that I got behind on because not only did we have to reinstall the site every day, I also had to be out of town for a speaking engagement. So I'm catching up on emails and on the K-Pods, so it's going to be a busy weekend, and we should be up, running, and spiffity-doo-bah by Monday. We'll be back with Bruce McAbee right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Dr. Bruce McAbee. Now, that's a name I think everybody knows, but and we sometimes say, and needs no introduction, but certainly deserves an introduction and deserves for everyone, even those who are brand new, maybe especially those who are brand new to the whole field of UFOs, UFO research and investigation, they need to know who he is. Bruce McAbee received a B.S. degree in physics at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Worcestershire, Massachusetts. Then at the American University in Washington, D.C., he received a Master of Science and a Ph.D. in physics. In 1972, he began a long career at what is now known as the Naval Surface Warfare Center, Dahlgren Division in Dahlgren, Virginia. And in 2008, he retired from that post. He has worked on optical data processing, generation of underwater sound with lasers, and various aspects of the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, and ballistic missile defense using high-powered lasers. He became interested in, or was probably already interested in, but became active in UFO investigations in the 1960s when he joined the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, known in shorthand as NICAP. In 1975, he became a member of MUFON and then was appointed the state director for Maryland and still holds that position. One of the things that Dr. McAbee is probably best known for, and this is only one among many, 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 but one of the things he's probably best known for is that he got the FBI to release a massive amount of documentation from their secret files on UFOs. And amazingly, this stuff was classified and put into a file called File X, or the X-Files. These are the real X-Files. Now, he's seen on television, he's heard on radio around the world, he's called in as an expert to examine and analyze photographs, video, and movie film, and so I know you're familiar with him. Dr. McAbee, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. I'd like to correct one thing you said. I am no longer living in Maryland, so I'm no longer the Maryland director.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I have moved to Northwestern Ohio.
Northwestern Ohio, okay. Well, do you have UFOs in Ohio?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And MUFON is here, too.
All right. Now, I want to get into, some of the more recent things, some of the things that are hottest for you in just a moment, but before we get into that, let me ask you a couple of things that sort of tie into your past, your resume. Now, you worked for the Navy at Naval Surface Warfare Center in Virginia, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you would have knowledge of these things, but I want to ask you if you do, Do you have any knowledge of what people are calling USOs, unidentified submerged objects? Have you run into information about that?
Well, yes, but not related to the Navy. My Navy work and has never intersected with UFOs. Or to put it another way, I've never gotten any information out of the Navy that indicated anything about UFOs.
Okay.
But, of course, the USO subject is written about in a number of books and has, I guess, been a subject of some small amount of discussion, I guess, for the last 30 years. Reports of objects, typically round, disc-shaped, or whatever, coming up out of the ocean and taking off or going down into the water or seeming to hover over the water and suck water up or whatever. One of the photo cases from Gulf Breeze, Florida, that occurred in, I think it was 1992 or 3, I can't remember the exact date now, in April, 94, I guess. A photograph taken by Ed Walter showing a column of a UFO hovering over the Santa Rosa Sound and a thin column of water going up to the bottom of the object. He saw that happen, took a picture of it. I remember looking up when I was active in old NICAP years ago, looking up in the NICAP files a report via in 1945, I think it was, somebody had written to NICAP that they're sighting while on a landing craft near Alaska. This man and 12 others were on this small ship and saw a object come up out of the water, hover for a couple of seconds, and then take off. And, of course, he knew that we didn't have anything that did anything like that. This was before the era of, quote, flying saucers, unquote, so he didn't know what he was looking at. At the time, he said that the people were interrogated after they landed on a shore. They were interrogated at some Navy base and then never heard about it again. He wrote his story to NICAP, I think, in 1957 or 58, so about 10 years after the sighting itself. But the point is, USOs have to do with objects associated with water, coming in, going out, taking on water, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I saw a documentary on television the other night, perhaps it was an episode of UFO Hunters. You were in it, but they were talking about USOs, and there was a report of somewhere in what we call the Bermuda Triangle of a Navy ship that on their sonar picked up a USO. And it was enormous. It was at a depth our submarines can't go to. And was traveling at 150 knots. And they had a good reading on it, and you know, but they had no idea what it was and still don't. Now, have you heard of other really phenomenal things these USOs can do? I mean, depths of thousands of feet and 150 knots, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the story about the Navy detection of something that was very deep and very fast, I think goes way back into the 60s.
Yeah.
And whether it's exactly the way you portrayed it or not, I don't know. It's something that we've never been able to track down to an official source. Somehow that story got out. I think Ivan Sanderson might have been the first person to write about it back in the early 70s. Well, I'm not sure about that. But the story itself has been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if that's something like that happened, the data would be classified as it was born, classified at birth.
Yeah.
Because of the instrumentation used to make the detections. Would have been classified. So I don't know where you would check up on that. You correctly pointed out that I obtained the FBI file, the first person to get the FBI file, which is about 1,600 pages, and the number of sightings that they had filed under the classification Security Matter-X was the name of the file, Security Matter-X, where they filed a number of sighting reports. And in the FBI file, which I got in 1977, there was a very interesting Navy report. The FBI had established connection with the Air Force in July of 1947. The Air Force had asked the FBI to investigate, to interview witnesses to see if there was any, if any of these UFO sightings that were being reported had something to do with communist subversion, creating spurious stories to make the American people think that the Russians had it all over us or whatever, because they could fly around in flying saucers and we couldn't. At any rate, once the FBI was locked into the Air Force, the Air Force and the Navy kind of descend some reports to the FBI, and the FBI was like a black hole. Reports went in, reports checked in, but they never checked out. At least not until 1977, when a very surprised FBI agent told me that he had found 1,600 pages of stuff, and he didn't even know there was a file on the subject. So anyway, in this file was a Navy report. And a point that I'm getting at is, the Navy report was interesting. It spurred me to write to the Navy directly under the Freedom of Information Act for all information that the Navy might have on UFOs. And they could not even find an original copy or even a copy of the Navy report that I had found in the FBI file. So you can see how poorly they kept records or whatever. At any rate, the person who handled my request way back in 77 or 78 sounded as if he was interested in the subject, and he was enthusiastic about looking up stuff, but he said he never could find anything except a report done by the Naval, the National Interpretation, Photo Interpretation Center, was run by the Navy years ago, and the analysis of two movie films, one from 1950 and one from 1952. But aside from that, he said we couldn't find anything that the Navy has on UFOs. Now, that's got to be a mistake. The Navy has to have stuff, but it must be so securely filed that you can't even get to it under the Freedom of Information Act. And I had nothing, my official duties had nothing to do with UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
In a situation like that, if you have no need to know, you don't find out anything. That's a standard top secret classification situation.
All right, now, if my information is correct, that FBI agent called you in May of 1977, so 32 years ago this month is when that FBI agent called you and, as you say, sounded surprised and said, you know, we got 1,600 pages of this stuff about UFOs. And since then, all of that has been posted online, right?
Yeah, you can go to... No, I haven't checked for a long time, but at least you used to be able to go to... it's a FBI site. I think it's foia.fbi.gov or something like that, which takes you to the FBI's Freedom of Information Act site, where you can learn all about everybody who's ever had a file, practically. And that includes their file on UFOs.
All right, now, they called this file Security Matter X. And then, of course, we're all familiar with the TV series X-Files. Do you know if they had a unit inside the FBI that was essentially... I know that there was a great deal of fiction in the X-Files, but essentially doing what the X-Files unit did, investigating things paranormal and UFO-ish.
Well, I certainly don't. I don't know of anything like that. And the information that became available from the flying disc file. Certainly did not indicate that they had an ongoing investigation, except for the period of time from about the middle of July 1947 till the end of August. Now, at the end of about in the middle of August, approximately, J. Edgar Hoover found out by from one of his liaison agents with the Air Force. He was told that the Air Force had brought in the FBI to take care of all the cases of ash cans and toilet seats that might be thrown into somebody's yard and claimed to be a UFO. In other words, he was told that the Air Force had brought in the FBI to handle all the trash cases.
Mm-hmm.
And J. Edgar Hoover, of course, didn't want to dissipate his agent's time handling trash cases. So he stopped the investigation by FBI agents. As I said before, though, once they had established this connection with the Air Force, the FBI acted like a black hole. They were accepting information from the Air Force. They weren't actively investigating. They didn't do any more interviews with witnesses after the end of August of 1947. But they retained information. And I asked the FBI agent, you know, well, how come they still have this stuff, you know, 30 years later? And he said that Congress had directed that any information sent to, that was at any time in the headquarters files of the FBI could not be destroyed. Field offices could hang on to stuff for up to 5 years and then destroy it if they wanted to. But the headquarters of the FBI could not destroy anything. So that's why these documents were still around in 1977 for me to start reading.
All right. Now, in those documents, I have seen a memo from J. Edgar Hoover complaining that I don't know if it was the Army or the Air Force had recovered a disc and that they would not allow the FBI to have access to it to investigate it. And he was complaining about that.
That's an important document because that was the beginning of the FBI, official FBI interest. That was in July of 1947. What happened was the Air Force, an Air Force general in intelligence, called over the FBI liaison man and outlined him to this man the problems that these flying saucer sightings were having. They were having with the flying saucer sightings and pointed out that even Air Force pilots were involved in the sightings. But they said they still wanted to be sure there was no communist subversion going on. So the liaison agent wrote a memo and set it up the chain of command, and it went to, J. Edgar Hoover's good buddy.
I know who you're talking about.
His name escapes me at the moment. It begins with a T, I think.
I know who you're talking about, but I can't think of it either.
He said, on this piece of paper, it's on the same piece of paper, on the back of a piece of paper that was that has this memo on it. Tolstoy, I can't think of the guy's name.
Tolson. Yeah.
Clyde Tolson.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Anyway, he said, I don't think we should do it. And under that, Hoover wrote a longer note saying, I would do it, but we must demand full access to all disks recovered. For example, in the L.A. case, this is capital L, small a, in the L.A. case, the Army grabbed it, would not let us have it for cursory examination. So at this point, Hoover is saying, yeah, well, we can investigate. After all, Hoover was really onto communist stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Air Force's suggestion that it might be communist subversion was all it needed. Was all he needed to attract the attention of Hoover. And so Hoover is saying, referring to this L.A. case, well, there was a case in not Los Angeles that some people have interpreted.
Okay, we're going to find out where that is when we come back. A break is taking over, so we've got to step out for just a moment. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and we're talking with Dr. Bruce McAbee. Dr. McAbee, I do apologize, but these breaks are automated, and when they take over, and our mics go dead. Okay, so we were talking about this this memo having to do with where Hoover wrote about the Army has to give us access to these discs, but they won't let us have access like in the L.A. case, and it was capital L, little a. And you were about to tell us where that took place.
Well, I was referenced to a case which is in the Air Force file and in the FBI file in Louisiana, where somebody threw a small, like a 2 or 3 foot model flying saucer or whatever that somebody had made, threw it into somebody else's backyard. It was making noise, and the guy called up the police or whatever and to report that he had this thing in his backyard, and it was making noise, and then the Army investigators went there and got it. And apparently, I guess, I don't know where they took it, but the point was they didn't give it to the FBI to look at. And the FBI would have wanted to look at it to find out, to analyze it, find out if there were any materials that were made in outside the United States. So anyway, Hoover said he would do it. He demanded full access to disks recovered. They never did get any access to any disks, according to the available documentation in the FBI file. They did interview a dozen, maybe, witnesses over the month and a half or so period of time that they were actively investigating. But that was about it. They never got any hardware.
All right. Are there other documents in the secret secret matters or Security Matters X file? Were there any other documents that you're aware of that where either Hoover or agents referred to recovered disks?
No. There is a document which refers to the Roswell case of 1947. And there's a statement in there which says that the FBI liaison guy was talking to the Air Force, and he was told that it was a balloon with a radar reflector, essentially. But then it says the way it's worded, they were talking to somebody at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base when they got this information, that they had been told that it was a balloon with a radar reflector, but conversation didn't bear this out or something. I forget exactly the wording. It sounds a little ambiguous and leaves open a crack in the Air Force's claim that it was a balloon with a radar reflector. It says that conversation with the Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base did not bear this out, implying that it was something other than a balloon with a radar reflector. But there's no FBI documentation that says what it was.
Have you run across any, because I know you, we're talking about this FBI Security Matters X file, but you've gotten documents from other agencies and from branches of the military. Did you ever run across any documents where Major Jesse Marcel underwent some kind of investigation as to why the air intelligence officer for the only nuclear-armed wing on the planet at the time did not know what a weather balloon looked like?
Well, I have not been a major investigator of the Roswell case. I'm not aware of a document that specifically talks about what you're talking about.
Don't you? I mean, I realize that you haven't looked into that specifically, but don't you find that a little bit odd? Here's this air intelligence officer.
After hearing Marcel testify on back in the early days, late 70s, early 80s, and seeing him in the film UFOs Are Real, which was a documentary done way back in 79 or 80.
And a good one, too.
Yes. And if you leave off the last 10 minutes, it still is good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I never doubted it, because I didn't believe that a guy with his intelligence could mistake rubber and balsa wood for something that you couldn't crease, you couldn't bend it. They'd try to hit it with a sledgehammer, according to his story, and it wouldn't bend. They couldn't burn it, you know. All this stuff that you can do to balsa wood sticks and tinfoil.
Yeah.
And plain old rubber.
I also find it amazing.
Cavett, Sheridan Cavett, was the guy who went with Jesse Marcel to the crash site.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Cavett wouldn't talk to anybody. Bill Moore tried to interview him back in the 80s and couldn't get him to say a thing of value. Then when the Air Force started to do their Roswell case closed type of report in 1995, I guess that was, they succeeded in interviewing Cavett because by this time, I guess he had received direction to allow himself to be interviewed. I have on my website a article entitled Cavett Emptor, which outlines, shows why Cavett's testimony is about as solid as a Swiss cheese. It's full of holes. His testimony, although ostensibly the Air Force uses it to shoot down Jesse Marcel's claims, if you analyze what he says in his interview, you can see why, in fact, his interview tends to support Jesse Marcel. Because in an indirect way, because of the errors in his document. For example, he says that the amount of material that was found was only a small amount that could be fit into one car easily. But the testimony from Marcel was that they had taken two vehicles out to the test site, filled both of them up, and then later people had to come back and pick up a whole bunch of stuff. Sheridan Cavett also said that he recognized immediately that it was just a weather balloon with a radar reflector. And so my question would be, then why in the world did he allow, why didn't he tell Jesse Marcel what it was? Why would he allow Marcel to believe that there was a large amount of material and it was all strange stuff as opposed to being just simple rubber, plastic rubber or and a radar reflector?
Well, there's another part of that story that, to me, is just amazing. When the news came out, you know, the press release, the original press release that the Army had recovered a flying disc, that went across this country like wildfire. ABC News was reporting it on radio. A few hours later, a day or two, you have General Ramey doing this little press conference in his office, in the outer office of his office, and that's where the pictures are taken of Jesse Marcel sort of kneeled down holding up some of the material, and the press is there, and the story is given to them that this was just misidentification of a weather balloon. What's amazing to me, here are these crack reporters, biggest story that's come down the pike in who knows how long. It had been all over this country in a flash that they had a flying disc, and not one single reporter asked that question of Marcel, this question. Wait a minute. Major Marcel, how is it that you, being the air intelligence officer for the only atomic armed wing on this planet, cannot identify a weather balloon? They didn't ask that.
Yeah, we don't know whether it was a free-for-all type of press conference or whether the general had just invited the press in long enough to take some pictures and then leave. But it's true that...
Well, that never came up in their reporting.
They seemed to accept this in spite of the supposed contradiction between what the guy ought to be able to know, what he ought to be able to identify, and what was claimed by the Air Force. The editorial in the Washington Post the next day was a bit skeptical about this. The way they wrote it indicated that they were skeptical about the explanation, but were willing to accept it as much as there was nothing else that seemed reasonable at the time. They seemed, however, skeptical that Marcel or the people, not just Marcel, I mean really the whole, everybody who had come in contact with it wouldn't recognize, there wouldn't be somebody there who would recognize it was simply a weather balloon.
Well, from a homoterracentric point of view, there's absolutely nothing about UFOs that's reasonable. And you know, but there's nothing about a lot of things out there in space that I'll call nature. There are a lot of those things that are unreasonable too. We don't, for instance, understand how it is. The scientists don't understand fully how it is that you can have a gamma ray burst, and that this thing will travel. It's directional. It'll travel in a direction rather than being omnidirectional. And you know, there are all kinds of theories and really smart guys and gals working on this all the time, but they really don't understand that. So there's no reasonable explanation for that. And there's no reasonable explanation for UFOs, but that has nothing to do with whether they exist or not. Now, you've seen at least one UFO, right?
I saw in Gulf Breeze, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a ring of light suddenly turn up like a chandelier up in the sky, suddenly turn on. It had eight lights in it, and was around for about 70 seconds. after it disappeared in the sky glow, I did not call the guys in white coats with butterfly nets to come and take me away, ho-ho, because there were 30 other witnesses, and it was videotaped and photographed and sound recorded and so on.
All right, now, look, there are a group of professional skeptibunkers that have done everything possible to discredit photographs and videos taken in Gulf Breeze. But you were there. You saw it. Is there any doubt in your mind that that was beyond human invention?
Well, I could imagine how it could be done, but it would not be simple. There's no doubt that it was there. As I said, I saw it. It was photographed. It was seen by 30 other people. And
could it have been balloons with flares tied to them?
At the time, what?
Could it have been balloons with flares tied to it?
I doubt that. This was, so far as I could tell, a rigid ring, and mm-hmm. it hovered for a period of time and then started to move. We have a photograph which shows that.
What about the wind? Was it
and video as well?
Mm-hmm.
And this was not the first case of its type in Gulf Breeze. And as a matter of fact, occurring in September 1991, this was one sighting in a series of almost 200 that occurred between November 1991 and July of 1992, I guess. Let's see, it must have been November 1990 to July of 1992. And what I saw was September 16th, 1991. It was the third or fourth sighting of a ring of lights, but previously they had been seeing red lights going through the sky, and sometimes cross winds and even faster than the wind. So I assumed that if this was all a big hoax, it was a rather massive hoax, considering the number of sightings and also dangerous. You know, it was just back last January that. Or back on April 1st, when a group of two skeptic guys announced that they had caused sightings in New Jersey in January of this year.
Yeah, I did three shows on that.
Yeah, now, those guys were censured for flying road flares on balloons.
We have to take a break again. We'll pick up with that when we come back, and I'll tell you why I suspect, maybe they did it, but why I suspect the whole thing was a after-the-fact disinformation operation, very possibly. We'll be back right after this. Welcome welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest, Dr. Bruce Maccabee. Dr. Maccabee, we got caught in a break again, so the floor is yours, sir.
Okay, I was talking about, really this is becoming a comparison between what happened in Gulf Breeze between November 1990 and July 1992, and what happened in January in, it was New Jersey, right?
Yes, Morristown, New Jersey.
Yeah, anyway, in Gulf Breeze, starting in November 1990 and running continuously for over a year, year and a half, there were new repeated sightings of a red light thing going through the sky, sometimes dropping stuff. And there were enough sightings so that people got to just plain going out every night to see if they could see something. And there were triangulations, that is the same object being seen by several different people in different locations, so that you could project the sighting lines from the different people to a common intersection point and determine where an object was, how big it was, how fast it was going, and so on. Unfortunately, I guess that didn't happen in the Morristown sightings. But the guys who admitted on April 1st that they had launched balloons with red flares, is my understanding. Is that right?
That is what they say, yeah.
Yeah, okay. In Gulf Breeze, they had these red lights as well. And the first thought was, well, somebody's launching stuff with red flares on it, which is a dangerous thing to do. But it became questionable as to whether that could be. It certainly wasn't just hanging from a balloon, although some of the sightings could potentially have been flares hanging from balloons. Most of the sightings had things like going across the wind or going faster than the wind was going. In one case, it was something with clock going almost 40 miles an hour up in the sky. But in the escalation of hypotheses, where you start from something simple and get more and more complicated, starting with simple being just a balloon with a flare on it. The balloons, obviously, and the flares go where the wind blows them. But something that's going to travel in a straight line at 40 miles an hour has got to have a propulsion mechanism in it. And especially if there's no wind to speak of to carry it along. So I imagine that there might be a motorized blimp with a flare hanging down below it or attached to it. Now, this thought had occurred to me in the months from November 1990 all the way through the summer of 1991. And by the time these rings of light started to appear, not just a single light, but a ring of lights and then a ring of white lights, not red. And when a ring of light started to appear in September of 1991, I decided I'd better go to Florida and find out what was going on. And so I was out there on September 16th, 1991, and sure enough, a ring of lights appeared. Now, one of the things I had with me was a so-called big ear, which is a parabolic dish with a sensitive microphone at the focus, and this allows you to pick up, you know, the typical spy situation. You listen to somebody whispering at a distance of 100 feet or something. And the reason I had that was I figured if this really was a hoax, where somebody had a motorized blimp carrying something or other, it couldn't be a fixed wing type aircraft. It could go too slowly to do that, and you didn't hear this typical noise. Nobody ever heard any noise from these things. You didn't hear the typical buzzing noise of a small model airplane.
Mm-hmm.
You could fly a flare hanging below a model airplane if you wanted to, but I don't know. It would have to be a pretty robust model airplane to be able to hang a flare from it and still have it fly.
Yeah, it would.
Envision something like a small blimp, you know, filled with gas, a gas bag, football-shaped balloon with a small airplane motor attached to the balloon, and then the balloon would float and hold up the motor and the flare. So I had this big ear listening and pointed it in the direction of the ring of lights to see if I could hear any noise. And I didn't. Couldn't hear a thing. The ring of lights had an angular size to it, which was measurable from the film, and which corresponded to 10 feet at a few thousand feet distance. I was looking up into a sky glow over Gulf Breeze, Florida. Lights from the ground were illuminating the moisture in the air up above, and it was the sky glow was enough so that you couldn't see the stars with your naked eyes. You could use binoculars and look, punch through the sky glow a bit and see some stars with binoculars, but you couldn't see them without. I could not, as I thought about this later, I realized something. I could see the ring of lights, but I could not see any supporting structure, even though I was looking with binoculars. Nobody saw anything other than just these points of light. And I said to myself, well, if this is a hoax, or even if it isn't a hoax, there's some structure holding these lights in a fixed position, one fixed relative position, one to the other. Eight lights in a ring. And I could not see any evidence of a structure at all. Now, thinking about it afterwards, I decided that must be because the lights were on the far side of the sky glow. Now, about a mile from where we were was a football stadium, high school football stadium, with a whole bunch of lights on. And they were illuminating the sky at a distance of a mile or so from where we were. And I concluded that there must have been, there had to be something, some sort of a framework holding these lights. It must have been that frame, I couldn't see the framework because of, put it like this, had the framework been between me and the sky glow, had it been within 1,000 or 2,000 feet, I would have seen a structure silhouetted against the sky glow. But I couldn't see anything silhouetted against the sky glow. I could just see the lights. That told me that the structure that was holding the lights must have been beyond the sky glow, which would put it a couple of miles away and make it 10 or 20, maybe 30 feet in diameter, which certainly puts it at the outer bounds of a hoax.
Yeah, it does.
Have some structure up there holding 100-watt light bulbs or whatever, you know.
And your expertise is in optical physics, right?
Right. So on thinking about it for a while, I decided that, I couldn't absolutely prove that it was an extraterrestrial craft up there. It certainly sounded that it wasn't any typical hoax, that's for sure.
Now, I realize that in your work with the Navy, that just the fact that you were with the Navy did not mean that you saw all these exotic things that they and other services may have been working on. However, you certainly would have seen or would have seen photographs of a lot of things that they were working on, and then just the normal stuff that we all know about. Did what you saw in Gulf Breeze look like anything that you had seen? Did it appear to be even related to anything that you had seen in all your work with the Navy?
No. But now I'd like to get back to the red light stuff, because that's where you get a comparison between the stuff in Morristown.
Mm-hmm.
The red lights, the sightings in Gulf Breeze, became so common that they gave a name to this red light thing, Bubba. Remember, what I saw was a ring of white lights, but my sightings was preceded and followed by sightings of these red things going through the sky. Well, now, in February of 1992, we finally got a measurement. I had bought some diffraction gratings from the Edmund Supply Company, diffraction gratings to stick inside a camera, and that splits the light up into its colors, color components, like a prism.
Yeah.
Except the diffraction grating is a little bit more accurate. So anyway, I sent some calibrated diffraction gratings down to the people in Gulf Breeze, and several people stuck them in their camera. And on February 5th of 1991, they got lucky, or 1992, I should say, they got lucky. And photographed a red light thing, the UFO on the unknown red light, with a camera that had a diffraction grating in it. And then they took a red flare and went a distance away from the camera, about 2 miles, which is what they thought that this other red light had been. So this is all happening on one night. They saw the red light. Wow, we got some pictures of it with the camera. Quick, let's take a flare and get pictures of that. So this is all recorded on video as well, and you can hear the people commenting during the first sighting of the red UFO. And then you can hear them commenting when the flare goes up, and they say, oh, it's not exactly the same color. And sure enough, the fraction grating proved that it wasn't the same color. The mix of red, green, and blue was different for the flare than it was for the red bubble thing. And it's unfortunate that we didn't have a diffraction grating for the Morristown sightings, because we could have either proved or disproved what the guys were saying.
But all right, we have to take a break. When we come back, I still want to talk about Morristown just a little bit, and then we'll open up the phone lines. Okay, folks, we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. All right, let's go back to Dr. Bruce Maccabee, and you were talking about these red lights and the Morristown thing.
That's right. I didn't follow the Morristown sightings very closely because, like MUFON, I sort of decided right off the bat that this probably wasn't something really going on. And then, of course, we had a situation where the guys went public on April 1st. But I had pointed out that it was too bad we didn't have a camera with a diffraction grating it for the Morristown sightings, because we could have proved or disproved their claim that one or more of the lights was a road flare. In the Gulf Breeze case, we had a diffraction grating in a camera which took on the same film, the same roll of film with the same camera and the same diffraction grating, a picture of a red bubba and a picture of a road flare. And the spectro composition of the two were different. So that's pretty good evidence that at least one of the red bubba things was something truly unusual in Florida.
Well, and as you said, some of them were observed flying crosswind,
yeah.
Which, of course, a balloon will not do.
That's why I escalated my hypothesis to the suggestion of a motorized blimp, which could be radio-controlled, maybe, and go across wind if you could. But when you have, they had 170, logged 170 sightings between November 1990 and July of 1992. 170 sightings, and probably about 150 of those were red bubba sightings. That's an awful lot of chances to take with, you know, having a flare fall on the ground, fall on a house, or fall on in a field where it could start a fire. That's what the guys in New Jersey were censured for. I guess they were fined or something. I don't remember exactly what happened to
them. Yeah, and they had to do community service, too. But now, in Gulf Breeze, I can't remember the guy's name, but there was a guy that took some Polaroid photographs of...
Walters, you're talking about.
Yeah. I took Polaroid photographs of one of these, or several of these UFOs, and sort of up close. I mean, not like standing right next to it, but close enough that you could see structure. You could see,
right.
You know. And there was there were a lot of debunkers that tried to jump on that. But I got to tell you something. I'm not an absolute expert on cameras, but I know something about them. And those were taken with a Polaroid SK-70 camera. And the way that works is you push the button, it spits the film out. You can't double expose it.
Oh, wait a minute. Those pictures taken by Ed, the first pictures in November of 1987, and then a series of pictures taken up through May of 1988, the first pictures... From November 87 until the 1st of March, he was using an old Polaroid camera of the type where you have a, I guess it had a film pack, but you had to pull the film out.
Okay, well, we're talking about a different set of pictures then, and must have been taken by someone else. The ones I'm talking about were taken with an SK-70. And, yeah, I know the ones you're talking about. They were the ones that were in all the magazines. But these, I saw these on television, and these were taken with an SK-70. And, you know, that's the one with the sort of Mylar or plastic cover over the picture. And that camera does not have the possibility of double exposure.
Yeah, I don't know what pictures you're talking about.
Okay.
You know that in the case of Ed, his old Polaroid camera, you could click any number of times and then pull a film out. So you could do double exposure, triple exposure, quadruple exposure, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then, because he had been criticized for having a camera, taking pictures with a camera that you could double expose, he bought a Model 600.
Mm-hmm.
With a Model 600, it's got a motor in it. You press the button, and the film ejects immediately, and it develops outside the camera.
Yeah, and it's the same type of film as the SK70.
Right.
It's just a different size.
From March 1988 onwards, was using a camera that ejected the film automatically.
Yeah.
So the argument, the same argument that the people had raised before, couldn't be used with this other camera.
Yeah. Yeah, the Model 600 is just a smaller film, is a smaller size, physical size.
The SX80 or whatever, I don't know, I'm not sure, familiar with what photos you're talking about then.
Okay. All right. Now, let's move forward in time. Before we open the telephone lines, we've been talking about some of the more interesting things that you've been involved in. But since all of that and coming up into today, what's hot right now? What have you worked on that made you raise an eyebrow or two?
Well, perhaps one of the Russian videos is quite impressive. It's one which shows it's taken in a shopping center, and the scene shows a building zooming in towards a building, and you see this object hovering right next to the building. It's a picture that reminds me of the August 1997 Mexico City video, which made national news at the time, or international news. That showed an object hovering at the left-hand side of an apartment house and moving to the right, so it was hidden behind the apartment house and rising up above the roof of the apartment house and then basically going off into the distance and disappearing or something. And that looked very good to begin with until, under intense analysis, we discovered something that I would call fingerprints of a hoax. And anybody who wants the technical details on that can go to my website and look up the.
You're talking about the one in Mexico City that had the fingerprints of a hoax.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about the Russian one?
Now, the Russian one, it's April 6th of this year. And you can actually go and see it there's a copy of it on the All News Web. You can actually go and see this thing. And although it has the same situation of the object, in this case on the right-hand side of the building, and then moving towards the building and disappearing behind it, I don't see any indication of the same fingerprints of a hoax that I saw before. Unfortunately, though, you really need something better than what they post on the web to do a very careful analysis. I guess this video is probably compressed and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, the shape of the object is convincing. And unfortunately, you don't really have any testimony. I don't know if anybody has actually interviewed witnesses. There are a number of witnesses who saw this, but it could be staged. It's just you would have to have somebody pretty good in computer generated imagery to insert this a UFO image into the video, and then you'd have to have one or more people willing to basically lie about a story of the sighting and go public with it. It's very difficult to analyze something when it's miles away, thousands of miles away, and worse than that, different language.
All right, now, that brings up something that...
Interesting video, and I would recommend it to anybody who is interested in trying their hand at seeing whether this could be faked or not.
That brings to mind something that happened, I think it was 1982. This would be, because it's Russian as well, the Phobos 2 satellite. And then, of course, I think her name is Marina Popovich from the Russian, I think she was Russian Space Agency.
Russian aviator. She was the most decorated female Russian aviator ever.
And she showed...
Popovich, who was a cosmonaut.
Mm-hmm. Well, she made public a photograph that is ostensibly the last photograph taken by Phobos 2 before it was decommissioned, and it shows something that I've read estimates as long, an object as long as 25 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
I've read estimates where it was smaller. Have you taken a look at this? And for those who are unfamiliar with this, this was a satellite that was supposed to be doing scans of Mars and of the moon of Mars called Phobos. And as it did scans of Mars, you can see a shadow of what appears to be a very large elliptical object moving across. You don't see the object, you see the shadow.
Yeah, I think it was Phobos.
Yeah. Okay, and then it turns back towards Phobos to take a picture, and all of a sudden it begins to spin out of control. And the last photograph it took shows this long cylindrical object. Have you taken a look at that and come to any kind of a hypothesis about it?
Ago, she wasn't the person who introduced that. That was floating around for some time before she became involved. But it's a rectangular area in the image, and I've always been suspicious that was something wrong with the photo itself, not that it was picking up a real object. And I think the Russian space agency made the same claim, that it wasn't an object out there, but that something had happened to the recording mechanism, the mechanism by which they record line by line what the images coming out of the spacecraft at any particular time.
How did they explain the shadow that appeared down on the surface?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't recall. I remember seeing the picture of the Phobos numerous times. I don't recall the shadow. I can only conclude that they didn't make as much, consider that to be as important as the whatever the image of Phobos.
All right.
I have not studied those things. Again, it's very difficult to do a careful study of something that happens a long distance away, especially if it's in another country and a foreign language. I did study Russian once, and I can actually read some of the words. I could pronounce the word, but I don't know what it means.
Well, I speak a little bit of Russian, but only because I speak Serbian, and there is some similarity. But when I get into Russian, I do have some difficulty, just like what you described. I can read and pronounce the word, but that doesn't mean I know exactly what it means.
Right.
However, if I listen to a conversation in Russian, I'll pick up enough to know sort of what we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
But only sort of. And it's those fine details that can really get you in trouble.
Yeah, right. The point is that it's very difficult to do an investigation when under those circumstances. I've been able to investigate, for example, the McMinnville case, McMinnville photos of 1950. Because I was able to get a hold of the actual negatives to work with.
Uh-huh.
I can't do better than that. And then I talked over the phone to Evelyn Trent, the lady witness. She and her husband saw this thing go past their farm back in May of 1950. And this is all written up on my website. I was able to do that even though it was a long distance. I could do it because I could talk to the lady on the telephone. The longest distance investigation I've ever done was New Zealand, and I actually was able to fly there. A TV station flew me to New Zealand where I could talk directly to the witnesses, and I got a hold of the original film. So when you have original stuff to work with and really warm-blooded witnesses to work with, you can do a good investigation. When you're just sort of looking at something and saying, that looks really neat, and, gee, I can't understand what they're saying. there's no way I can, you know, this Russian video, it'd be nice to look at it frame by frame, uncompressed. How I could get a hold of that, I don't know.
Well, I have audience in Russia, so just perhaps the message will get passed along and maybe somebody will contact you. I hope so. What about the Stephenville sightings from last year? Have you looked into that at all?
The January 2008 produced one video that seemed to be of interest, the one by Karen, C-A-R-O-N.
Okay.
I can't remember the guy's first name.
Why was it of interest?
Well, the main sightings were on the 8th of January, as I recall, and it was like the 9th or 10th that the story came out, and then was picked up by national news. And it was one of the witnesses of the January 8th sightings, this is 2008, made an offer of some amount of money for somebody who came up with a video of the object. Well, now, Mr. Karen saw something off on the horizon, I guess. On the 19th, I think it was, of January, 10 days or so after the main sightings, he videotaped it, and his videotape showed these squiggly lines and multicolored wiggling around and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this attracted a lot of interest. I guess it's still on the web. It took a long time to get there, but it did. And when I saw the video when it was on the web, I thought there was something weird about the camera. Now, I didn't do any direct investigation of talking to the witness or anything. I just looked at the video itself. And I concluded there was something funny about the way the camera was taking the pictures that would made all these squiggly images. Subsequently, I bought myself a camera of the same type, because I had an older camera which was dying, and I decided I want a new camera anyway, so I got one of the same type, and then I found out that this JVC type camera, in its night shot mode, slows down the film, the frame rate.
Mm-hmm.
A Sony camera sends out an infrared beam and picks up the infrared beam reflection in the so-called night shot mode. In the night shot mode for the Sony camera, you're running at the normal 30 frames per second. But with the JVC camera, in order to increase the brightness of an image that's in very low light situation, the camera slows down from 30 frames a second down to as low as 2 frames a second, half a second per frame. Now, as anybody who has used a camera should know, when you're holding it in your hands, it wobbles around. And if you zoom in on something, you're narrowing your field of view, you're making the effect of hand vibration even more and more important. So if you try to film, for example, a star off on the horizon or some light up in the sky, and you zoom in on it while you are holding the camera, it will appear to move around a lot. Now, Mr. Karen tried to compensate for this by holding the camera against a post. I did my experiments with the same type of camera, and I held my camera against a car. I don't think anybody hold it against me for holding it against a car, whereas Karen held it against a post. What I found was when you zoom in, you're looking at a very narrow field of view, which is a small angle. The hand vibration continues anyway. Guess what? You can't beat your pulse.
That's true.
Even if you have it pressed against a wall or something, the pulse in your hand is enough to wobble the camera a little bit. Now, when the camera is taking pictures at 30 frames a second, this wobble doesn't stretch the image very much in a given frame. But when you're taking 2 frames per second, half a second per frame, there's plenty of time for hand wobble to make the image streak around, cause an elongated image, a wiggly image, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I concluded that whatever Mr. Karen filmed, these wiggly images that some people interpreted as alien writing or something were actually a result of hand vibration, Now, his pictures also show multicolored effects, and I have on my website, which I suppose we should refer to sometime or other.
Yeah, go ahead.
www.brumac.8k.com, brumac.8k.com. Or you can just do a Google on my name, Bruce McAbee. At any rate, I have on that right up in the front, when you get to the first page of this website, my analysis of a extraterrestrial source videotaped by one of these cameras, and the effect of light coming along, traveling along pathway a long distance through the atmosphere, which is what happens with an extraterrestrial source when it's near the horizon or even 10 or 20 degrees above the horizon. Light going through the atmosphere gets refracted, like in a prism,
mm-hmm.
and converted into, and so what happens is you get changes in the light color, the color, actual color of the light source. The colors sort of move around. It's sort of like looking at something through a prism and twisting the prism back and forth. So you might see red, green, blue, white, red, green, whatever, as a series of color changes. And sometimes the color changes happen during within half a second, and that will cause a streak, an image which is moving around because of your hand vibration. The image is moving around, and the atmosphere is changing the color of it. So you get a combination of streakiness or elongation plus color change just by videotaping at a slow rate, a slow frame rate, just by videotaping a distant light source.
Do you think
say that Mr. Karen didn't videotape a UFO, but the characteristics of the video image could indicate that he had simply videotaped a bright star or a planet off in the distance?
Okay, now, I have seen some pretty up-close video of what just looks like a big sphere of light. Okay, it does not look like a light that's in a fixture, okay, or attached to something, just a ball that itself is light. And I've seen this video of these things hovering above the desert south of Phoenix, taken with a telephoto lens, taken using a tripod. And you can see one of these balls of light begins to divide. And you can see one side get larger than the other, or the dividing line sort of moving to the right so that the left side is larger. And then it moves back, and then it joins together again. Have you ever seen video that had those kind of characteristics?
Well, I'd have to say maybe. I've seen an awful lot of videos, so I don't specifically know what you're talking about. I guess.
Well, it just looks like self-contained light.
Uh-huh. You're not talking about a video that's so-called the Phoenix Lights videos. Of
No. No, this was shot south of Phoenix at a completely different time. And it was shot, pointed towards the Australia mountain range,
uh-huh.
which is itself further south. And but we see these kinds of things above Phoenix not infrequently. And but this is the first good, clear video that I've ever seen of them. And they appear, you know how a Tesla coil and it kind of has those little lightnings inside of a glass bulb. That's going on inside of these lights, pardon me, lights in the sky. And because of tree lines and things, you can see they are in the sky. We have to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll open the phone lines when we come back. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Bruce Maccabee, and what a great privilege it is to have him with us. And we want to open the telephone line so that you can call in if you have a question or if you have a comment, and address those directly to Dr. Maccabee. The telephone number is 602-539-9580, or toll-free at 1-888-223-4599. Now, obviously, if you happen to be outside of the United States or outside of Canada, you can call those numbers and they will work. However, they're not toll-free. Neither one of them is toll-free if you're not in Canada or if you're not in the USA. Please feel free, if you want to pay for the international phone call, we'd love to hear from you. Or you can go to my website, which is kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down the page, and you'll see in the center of the page, as you scroll down, you'll see a link that says Flash Message. You can click that and send me a flash message with your question or comment. Okay? If you're in Canada or the USA, please use the telephone numbers 602-539-9580 or 888-223-4599. Let's go to the telephone line. And, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, this is Ryan in Washington State.
Hi, Ryan.
And, boy, it's a real privilege to be on the air with Mr. Maccabee. I'm a little bit nervous, but I have so many questions, but I doubt there's enough time to ask them all, so I'll just kind of make it short. But I'll hang on the line, Kevin, after I'm done. I just
all right.
wanted to ask, a lot of people are seeing things through night vision goggles. The Ed Grimsley thing is really kicking off. People are seeing things. I have no doubt that they're seeing something. But I wanted to ask, what kind of studies or what kind of things can, what other things can we do to further do more research on it? The question I have is that there hasn't really been any real scientific, like nobody's written a paper on it or anything. So I just wanted to ask you your expertise. What do you think about this night vision phenomenon that's been going on with night at Grimsley? I'm not sure if you've been keeping up with that.
Well, I have, in fact, looked at some video taken by people with using infrared and also people using image intensifier. Now, there's two types of night vision. The image intensifier type intensifies visible light, and it can sort of like turn darkness into daylight, or it seems that way. When you look up into the sky, you may be able to faintly see stars and so on. You look through one of these image intensifier things, and the stars become very bright points of light. Typically, the way that it's built, it's the image is amplified and projected onto a greenish-colored screen, the green color of the phosphor of the screen. And so you'll get these greenish-colored images being recorded by an ordinary video camera, for example, and couple it to a night vision device, and you end up with some sort of a greenish color. That's the type of image intensifier that makes use of the light coming from the source. Then there are also much more expensive thermal imaging cameras, which detect levels of heat. So something that you can't see at all with an image intensifier could still turn up with a thermal imaging. I know I have on my website one particular case that I analyzed where some policemen using thermal imaging as part of their police work happened to videotape with this thermal camera something that was traveling along beside their helicopter as they were traveling along in Florida. That's on my website. You could read about that. That's kind of interesting. I don't know of any very many thermal things. Probably everybody remembers the 2004, March 2004 case in Mexico. The Mexican Air Force flying over the Yucatan Peninsula, getting a bunch of lights in their infrared forward-looking infrared viewing camera. Those lights very probably were distant oil well flares. As far as the image intensifier stuff is concerned, I have seen some video of lights moving in the sky. People can just videotape looking upwards, and you can see satellites going over and maybe other things as well. One video I saw, the object seemed to change direction abruptly, but unfortunately it was almost faded out of view at the time that it changed direction. So we couldn't be sure that it was just one object changing direction or if there was one object going one direction and it happened to intersect the path of an object going in another direction. There is no doubt that you could in principle pick up stuff with these cameras that you wouldn't be able to see with your naked eye. But whether it's going to be any more informative than the so-called occasional images that turn up in ordinary photography. There have been a lot of ordinary photographic images, ordinary photographic pictures taken where some object will appear in the photo that the person taking the photo didn't see at the time, or at least didn't notice.
I'll take it off the air, Kevin. I'll free up the line, but I think it'd be really fascinating to get Ed in. I don't know if you're still involved in the field, Mr. McAfee. You're so invaluable. All those older photographs to me are so much more important than the newer ones, because nowadays, I mean, just scrolling across YouTube and across the internet, it's almost somebody that pays attention to this field is inundated almost on a daily basis with so many videos that it's almost impossible to tell which ones are the ones that, I mean, the ones.
Yeah, Ryan, I have to move along. I have other calls holding, but thank you for the call. Very interesting. Let me say that I have Dr. McAfee look through Ed Grimsley's night vision equipment, and I have seen things moving in ways that satellites don't move, and I can't say what they are, but I think I can say they were not satellites. They weren't bats, and they weren't birds, and they weren't bugs either. And I think I'll make a statement. We'll see what you think about this, and then we have to take this next call. When you use night vision and you see a bat, it looks like a bat. If you saw it in the daytime, you would say that's a bat. When you look at it through night vision, it still looks like a bat. It's just kind of greenish. You see a bird, it still looks like a bird. All it does is intensify what you were talking about, the image intensifier, a light intensifier. All it does is intensify the very faint but available light. So things still look like they look. Their color is different, but a bird looks like a bird, a moth looks like a moth, and a bat looks like a bat, and a satellite looks like a satellite. But when you see them making changes of direction and doing things satellites don't do, can't say what they are or who they are, but I think you can say it's not a satellite.
Yeah, you have to understand that sources of light objects that are creating their own light can be picked up by these image intensifier things, but image intensifiers can also pick up objects which are reflecting light, even if there isn't very much light available.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be careful. For example, a small object like an insect flying 10 or 15 feet above your camera or above your image intensifier and lit by a match. I mean, you might have a street light somewhere or some sort of a source of light, just enough to create a slight reflection off this thing, and your image intensifier can pick it up. With thermal imaging, you are picking up heat generated by an object. So I would be really interested in seeing thermal images that appear that have shape. If you use so-called mid-wave infrared imaging, an object which is generating some small amount of heat in the midwave will look like its shape. People videotaping airplanes and so on, off in the distance using a thermal imaging system, you'll be able to recognize the airplane, but you'll also see hot spots where the engines are.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's go back to the phone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Dominic from Toronto, Canada calling.
Hi, Dominic.
Kevin, great show like always.
Thanks.
My question to Dr. McAmey is, since he's a foil expert, and I do believe he is, what did he actually think about the Phoenix lights? Did he actually think the video was flares, or do you think it was something else?
There's a big analysis of this on my website. The March 13th, 1997 so-called Phoenix lights, now there's two separable events there, although they were entwined together by the witnesses and by the MUFON investigators right at the very beginning. They are nevertheless separable events. At 8:30, something went directly over Phoenix, and people were looking straight up at the bottom of it and seeing maybe some lights associated with it, but also some sort of a weird structure, craft, a triangle, a V, whatever you want to call it. Even Governor Symington admits to have seen that. That was part of a track of an object that started. It was first seen, I guess, around Prescott, Arizona, and was picked up at various places as it went southward, passed over Phoenix, continued south towards Tucson. Now, at 10 o'clock, approximately, I only know of four groups of witnesses, but there may have been more, but there were only four groups of witnesses who actually videotaped objects that were off on the horizon, not directly overhead, but off in the distance. Probably the most famous video is what I call the Kristen Arc, obtained by Mike Kristen from his house in the northern part of Phoenix, looking southward over the main city of Phoenix, the western half of the main city of Phoenix, and looking over the Estrella Mountains. The witnesses, and probably the best known witness is Dr. Lynn Katai, who originally wanted to remain anonymous. She was known as Dr. X, and then became known as Dr. Lynn. And then when she published her book called The Phoenix Lights, she went public with her full name. She and Kristen and another man, Chuck Reardon, were the primary videotaping witnesses to this thing. And I actually went to their houses, determined their sighting lines, and found that when I plotted their sighting lines on a geographical survey type map, that the sighting lines crossed a distance 60 or 70, maybe 80 miles south-southwest of Phoenix. In other words, although they thought they were looking at lights that were right over Phoenix, they were looking at lights that were a long distance away. That's what the triangulation shows. Now, they claimed that in the videos that they obtained, these lights were perfectly stationary. However, I was able to analyze frame by frame the videos and show that, in fact, the lights were dropping downwards and to the left. Dropping downwards is not surprising if they were flares off in the distance. Moving to the left is also not surprising if there are flares off in the distance, because the whole air mass was moving from the west towards the east at the time.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. More from Dr. Bruce McAmey and from your telephone calls. Don't go away. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Dr. Bruce McAmey. Let's go to the telephone line, if I can get the telephone to release that and put this person on hold. All right, here we go. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario. Hello there, Kevin, and hello there, Mr. McAmey. It is an honor to speak with you.
Oh, it helps if I push his button and bring him online, too. Are you with us, Dr. McAmey?
Hello there, Bruce. Did you hear me?
Yeah, we have pilot error here in the studio. I didn't push all the buttons.
That's all right, Kevin. We've all done it. I did it, too, when I was had my placement on radio. Bruce, so from the research that you've done, you know, there's apparently from, from the research I've done, the research you've done, you know that there's these UFOs have been piloted, the genuine ones that are extraterrestrial. The ones that are piloted by extraterrestrials, what shape of UFOs would you assign to certain groups? What what groups would you assign to certain UFOs?
What groups of entities correspond to certain shapes of UFOs?
Yes, yeah, so like the Greys and the Greys, the Anunnaki, the tall whites that have been known and told about, even the reptilians. From research that you have done, what type of craft would you associate with certain of these groups?
Well, I haven't tried to do any statistical analysis similar like that. It appears that mostly roundish type of craft have these grays in, I guess. I don't know what other. Sometimes the praying mantis shape or whatever are associated with the grays. I kind of think that you get all types in circular craft. I don't know if there's anything special that would come in like cylindrical type craft. But like I said, I have not tried to do a study of what type of creature corresponds to what type of craft.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. All right, let's see. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Paul from New York.
Hi, Paul.
Okay, Dr. McAbee, I was wondering if you ever researched or looked at any of Billy Meyer's photos and videos and what you thought of them.
Yeah, Billy Meyer has photos and film, not videos. Videos in recent years. But the film, I did analyze one section of film, and the analysis is on my website, where it looks like the thing is swinging back and forth, undergoing pendulum-type motions. I haven't spent a lot of time analyzing Meyer's photos, because, as you're probably aware, there's an awful lot of controversy over the pictures.
Yes.
I simply said that I can't say that Meyer never had a UFO experience. It's just that I don't use any of his information and when I'm making lectures or whatever to try to prove that UFOs are real.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. The Billy Meyer's case has been the definition of controversial really from the beginning. And there are people divide up on that almost religiously when they talk about it. They get fervent about it when they talk about either for or against.
Right.
And that, to me, is pretty interesting. That is a phenomena in itself that's pretty interesting. All right, now you're of the opinion that UFOs are real, and you've done an analysis of Project Blue Book as well as the Condon Report. You concluded, as many others did, that Condon actually, for all practical purposes, lied about the findings of the Condon Committee. Project Blue Book, you took a look at report number 14 and did an analysis of that. It's my contention that actually is the U.S. government saying UFOs are real, because they admit there are a great many they could not identify, and they were the ones with the most detailed information.
Right. Special Report 14 is quite interesting for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that after it was published, they printed 100 copies or something, and it was essentially for official use only. A very few copies got out of the government. But I was fortunate to get a hold of a copy in the early 1970s and do my own analysis of it. The government, at the time that it was published, they had a press conference in 1955, I think it was, when it was publicized that it existed. Although it had apparently been finished by 1953, it wasn't publicized until then, a couple of years later. And it was accompanied by a press release which said that, oh yeah, there had been a number of unidentifieds. But what they said was the number of identified cases has decreased over the last couple of years due to better analysis and reporting techniques, or words to that effect. They didn't say, they didn't point out that the, from 1947 to 1952, about 25% of the cases, as I recall, were unexplained, were unknowns, classified as unknowns. And only by carefully reading the report and finding out how rigorous the analysis was could you really appreciate what that meant. They had three possible classifications for a particular, any particular sighting could be considered to be explained, identified, whatever you want to call it, or insufficient information for identification, or unknown. And they had several different people who had to evaluate each particular case, and they all had to agree on unknown. If any one of them thought there was an explanation, then that would be put in either insufficient information or explained. So it was very difficult for a case to become an unknown. And then it turned out that when they divided the cases into quality or groups of varying quality, good, let's see, excellent, good, doubtful, and poor, four different levels of quality of the report, which was based on the testimonial evidence and self-consistency of the report and so on, they found out that the largest percentage of unknowns was in the group of reports which were considered to be excellent. In other words, the better the report, the better, the more educated the reporter and so on, the more likely it was that an unknown would be an unknown after analysis. And for just the military people themselves, most sightings that were done by military people on duty, 33% of the military sightings were unknown. Now, they didn't tell the public this in the press release when they published Special Report 14. As I said, they said that instead what they did was they pointed out that the number of unknowns had been reduced, the implication that everything would be explained if they had had more information, which was...
But in fact, the more information they had, the less likely it was that they could explain it away.
The better the case, the more likely it was to be unexplainable.
Yeah. All right. Now, all of these, your analysis of Blue Book, your analysis of the Condon Report, that's all on your website, right?
Yes.
All right. Tell us again the web address.
This is www.brumac.8k.com. Brumac.8k.com.
All right, and we will link Dr. Maccabee's photograph to that. So shortly after the show, you'll be able to just click on his photograph on my site. It'll take you over to his website. Dr. Maccabee, we've reached the end of the show. I want to thank you for being with us. If you will, stay on the line with me just a moment. And ladies and gentlemen, immediately following the show, it's Friday night. So you get a movie, all right? That's something that we haven't done in a long time. An old sci-fi movie, Phantom from Space. Hang in there. My friends call me Steel. I and my enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.